long yesterday. I forgot that the class was only supposed to be an hour. You guys are very polite not to cut me off. But if it happens again, just throw something at me. That's fine. You guys need a break before the next course. So we're going to continue with where we left off yesterday, this idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking. And just to recall, the motivation is that normally if you write down terms in the Lagrangian that violate a gauge symmetry to generate a mass for some photon-like state, then you run into problems with renormalizability, which means that you don't have a predictive theory. So the way to get around this is through spontaneous symmetry breaking, and we'll see how that works. So let's just sketch in kind of a toy context what kind of one of the important features of spontaneous symmetry breaking is. It's the idea that even if the Hamiltonian preserves a symmetry, yeah?
Yeah, so a little question about non-renormalizable theory. Suppose I have a non-renormalizable theory, and there is a certain cutoff there, right? But people also say that physics is, or that a specific physical theory is supposed to break down at a certain cutoff. So it's insane, not necessarily that bad. There is a cutoff, right? You just don't know what it is. So can't you just do measurements to determine what the cutoff is and then do calculations?
Philosophically, yes. Let's see exactly how I want to answer the question. The idea is that you need for every so you're always free to introduce non-renormalizable operators in your theory. But the problem is you have to fix those coefficients through some measurement. Okay? And you're free to do that, but the problem is if you want to So if you want to have a theory, then in a sense you would need to do an infinite number of measurements to fix all of the coefficients of your non-renormalizable theory. And so you're free to do that at a scale below the cutoff of your theory. That's perfectly fine. But if you're willing, if you want a theory that works at all scales, then of course that's bad. And at some point you'd expect that the standard model should break down and you would have to replace it by something else. At which point, maybe you do expect non-renormalizable operators to appear, which would be physics beyond the standard model. So that's perfectly fine. I don't know if I answered your question.
So you say that the need for renormalizable theories is only there if you actually want your theory to be valid at all scales.
Mm-hmm.
But you also say that we don't want our theory to be valid at all scales, that we know that that's just not possible right now.
Yeah, OK. Let me mention one other thing. So if you want the theory to be valid at the scale of the photon, the mass of this photon-like state, the mass of Victor boson, then you would need to include non-normalizable operators at that scale. So that's sort of the goal that we want for the standard model. We want to write down a theory that's valid at that scale that we don't need to write down, and maybe even beyond that scale, where we don't need to include all of these additional non-renormalizable operators. Did that answer your question? Yeah? OK. All right. So let's see where we left off last time. So the basic idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking is that the ground state can have a lower energy, I should say, with broken symmetry. Can have a lower energy than the state where the symmetry is preserved. So let U be a symmetry that relates. Getting ahead of myself. Symmetry that leaves the Hamiltonian invariant. So if I have U acting on H, then this is equal to U. Sorry, this is equal to H. All right. So now I'm going to say that we have two states. Are related by U. So just to be a little more concrete, you can think of state A as an electron with a given momentum k, and state B as, let's say, an electron neutrino with a given momentum k. And in the standard model, those two things are related by an SU2 transformation. So if they're related here, then what I want is that U acting on A should be equal to my state B. So let me just write out these states in terms of creation operators. So A should be a dagger acting on the vacuum. And state B should be the creation operator for state B acting on the vacuum. And then in order for this relation here to be satisfied, the creation operators for states A and B must also be related to one another through the symmetry transformation. So I must have U acting on A dagger for state A, U dagger must be equal to AB dagger. So then I can show how this relation here works. Straightforward. So if I have U acting on state A, this is U, creation operator acting on the vacuum. And so I have U, A dagger for state A, U dagger U acting on the vacuum. So here I just insert the identity, U dagger U. And this is equal to B, since this whole thing is just equal to A dagger for state B. But I also need to require that the symmetry transformation acting on the vacuum is equal to the vacuum. So this thing must be equal to the vacuum. And if that's true, then now I just have state B. So provided that the ground state is invariant. So U acting on the vacuum gives us back the vacuum. Now we can show that state A and state B have the same energy. So I can write that the energy of state A is just A Hamiltonian state A, which is just state B. U H dagger U dagger state B. There's a dagger here. And then this is just equal to B H B, and so that's just the energy of state B. So what I'm trying to show is that the energy of state A is equal to the energy of state B. But there's this implicit hidden assumption, which is that the ground state must be invariant under the symmetry transformation. If it's not, then the energies don't need to be equal to one another. All right? And so, of course, the electron mass is not the same thing as the electron neutrino mass. Yes?
Can So which one are you demanding that the ground state is invariant order, or is that another? Which one follows?
Which one follows? You need both. So the creation and annihilation operators have to be related like so. And then you also need that the ground state is in both is invariant.
So both.
Yeah, both. Or you require this one, and then you require what's on the upper board, or the middle board, I should say. This line here. So there's an implicit assumption that if you violate this assumption that the ground state's no longer invariant, then the spectrum also no longer needs to satisfy the symmetries of the theory. Okay. So the symmetry will no longer be manifest in the spectrum of the theory, but what we'll find out is that there will be certain properties that the parameters of the theory will satisfy, which will keep track of the fact that you started originally with a symmetric theory. Okay, so now our goal is to cover the Higgs mechanism, which illustrates this idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking. And we're going to work up to it. In the standard model, it's a little complicated because the relevant symmetry is a gauge symmetry, SU2 cross U1. And so we're going to work up to that step by step. So to start out, we're going to discuss a theory with a discrete symmetry. So we're going to consider a theory with a real scalar field. Here's the Lagrangian, 1 half d mu phi squared minus 1 half mu squared phi squared minus lambda over 4 phi to the fourth. I'm assuming that we have a symmetry, a discrete symmetry, which is a Z2 symmetry. So that just means that you can replace phi goes to minus phi, and then Lagrangian is invariant. So that's why I didn't write down a linear term and why I didn't write down a cubic term, because those would violate the Z2 symmetry. So I can write down the Hamiltonian. It's just 1 half phi dot squared plus 1 half the gradient of phi squared, and then plus the potential, which I'll write like this. And the potential is just 1 half mu squared phi squared plus lambda over 4 phi to the fourth. Now I just want to ask, how do I choose the field phi to minimize the energy, minimize the Hamiltonian? So since the phi dot squared term and the gradient of phi squared term are positive, we want to choose phi is equal to a constant. So phi dot is equal to 0, and the gradient of phi is equal to 0 to minimize the energy. So minimizing the Hamiltonian is simply a function of minimizing the potential energy. All right. So also, we need to have lambda be greater than 0. Otherwise, the Hamiltonian would be unbounded from below. That is bad. But mu squared can have either sign. So mu squared can be positive, negative. So I'll just sketch the two cases. If e squared is positive, it will look like this. And if it's negative, then it will look like this. So for the first case, the minimum is at 0. In the second case, the minimum is not at 0. Here. So the ground state is achieved when the field phi takes a value at that minimum. So you would write that the expectation value of phi with respect to the vacuum is either 0 or it's non-zero. So this will be equal to some non-zero constant, which I'll just call v, which is non-zero. So we can find v, of course, just by minimizing the potential. So here we go. So we want to compute where the derivative of v with respect to phi is equal to 0. And this is just mu squared phi plus lambda phi cubed, where phi is equal to v, is equal to 0. And so this tells us that v is just equal to plus or minus the square root of minus mu squared over lambda. And since mu squared is, remember, mu squared is negative, so the term appearing in the square root is positive. This quantity v is called the vacuum expectation value. Of the field phi, just telling us that in the ground state, what value does phi take? All right. So now that we figured out the ground state, we want to figure out what are the physical states. Physical states we want to treat as effectively as small oscillations about the minimum of the ground state. And the reason you think of it as small oscillations is because you want the free part of the Hamiltonian to be a simple harmonic oscillator, right? And so when you expand about the minimum of the potential, it will look like a simple harmonic oscillator. So what we need to do is expand around the minimum. And so we need to define a shifted field . So I'll write our original field phi as v plus some shifted field phi prime to expand about the minimum in the broken case. V is positive or negative. I'm free to choose either one. It doesn't matter due to the symmetry transformation. So I'm going to take V greater than 0. So now I just expand the Lagrangian. So I have 1/2 d mu phi prime squared. D mu acting on v just gives us 0 because it's a constant. And then I need to plug in for the potential. And so I have 1/2 mu squared b plus phi prime squared minus 1/4 lambda b plus phi prime to the fourth. And when I expand all of this out, I get 1/2 mu phi prime squared. I get a quadratic term, minus mu squared phi prime squared. I get a cubic term, which is minus lambda v phi prime cubed, and then minus lambda over 4 phi prime to the fourth. All right. So even though the original theory didn't have a cubic term, the shifted theory does. And so it violates the symmetry. There's no Z2 symmetry for phi prime. There's no linear term, of course, because we're expanding around the minimum. The linear term vanishes. We can write down the mass. So the mass is just minus 2 mu squared. Again, it's a positive number, which, using the condition for the VEV, is just lambda 2 lambda times v squared. This is the mass squared. Okay, so there's the mass. It's different by a factor of 2. The mass squared is different by a factor of 2 compared to the unbroken case. So you have the appearance of this new term that violates the symmetry, or I should say there is no symmetry for the shifted fields. And so how do you look at this Lagrangian and infer that there originally was a symmetry? Well, the key thing is that all of these terms are no longer independent. There's only two coefficients, two constants in your underlying Lagrangian. There was mu squared, and there's lambda. And the new term that appears depends on those coefficients as well. So we have three constants in the Lagrangian, which are determined in terms of two coefficients. So I'll just write out what I just said. So the original symmetry is not manifest. But it's hidden, or I should say it's reflected, in the fact that the three constants for the quadratic, cubic, and quartic terms are all related to one another. So now we'll do a slightly more complicated Higgs sector, or scalar sector. So we're going to consider an abelian global symmetry. Instead of the discrete symmetry. So let's say we have a complex scalar, phi. We have a U1 symmetry. So that is phi goes to e to the I alpha phi. So here's the Lagrangian. I have d mu phi dagger, d mu phi minus. Let me write the mass term as a plus, because I'm going to take the mass term to be negative. And so let me just define mu squared to be a positive constant. So I'll write it like this, mu squared phi dagger phi. And then I have minus lambda phi dagger phi squared for the quartic term. All right. OK, so it's invariant under the U1 transformation. So we're assuming lambda must be greater than 0 due to positive definiteness, and that mu squared is also greater than 0, which means that we have spontaneous symmetry breaking. So again, we need to think about what is the potential. Minus mu squared phi dagger phi plus lambda phi dagger phi squared. So let me just try to sketch that. So this will be the real part of phi, the imaginary part of phi, and this direction will be V. All right. So here's what it looks like. It's similar to what we wrote down before. For the discrete case, just rotate it around the origin. So we'll have something that looks like this. And I should think of it as rotated. So it makes something shaped like this. OK, so people call that like a Mexican hat potential, or the shape of the bottom of a wine bottle. So where's the minimum? Well, it's any point along the circle that goes through the bottom over here. So there's an infinite number of minima, which are all the same. So we're free to choose one that we want when we minimize the potential. So what we want to find is where dv by d phi is equal to 0. And so this is just minus mu squared plus lambda phi dagger phi times phi dagger is all equal to 0. And so it's satisfied when the magnitude of phi is equal to the square root of mu squared over 2 lambda. So when the magnitude of phi has this particular value, which, of course, just defines a circle. So I'm going to call this V, or just for simplicity, I'm going to call it V normalized to square root of 2, for reasons that will become apparent in a little bit. But it doesn't matter. So next, what I want to do is rewrite the Lagrangian in terms of the shifted fields. And so to do this, first we need to pick exactly which minimum we're talking about. So there's an infinite number. And so you're free to choose whatever you like, just because if you choose, make a different choice, you just do a gauge transformation, or a U1 rotation to change your choice. So I'm free without loss of generality to assume that, let's say, only the real part of phi is the one that acquires a VEF. VEV, if I didn't mention it before, stands for vacuum expectation value. So only the real parts will become non-zero. So let's write the following. So I'll write my complex field phi as 1 over square root of 2 phi 1, which is the real part, plus I phi 2, which is the imaginary part. And again, phi 1 gets a VEV, vacuum expectation value. So what I'm going to assume is that the vacuum expectation value phi 1 will be this V over square root of 2. And the vacuum expectation value phi 2 will just be 0. And again, I'm totally free to do this without loss of generality. So now I wanted to find the shifted fields. So I'll define phi 1 is equal to phi 1 prime, I should say v, plus phi 1 prime. Sorry about that. This should not be square root of 2, because there is already a square root of 2 here, so this is just v. So there's the shifted fields for phi 1. And then phi 2 is just equal to phi 2 prime, because I don't need to perform a shift, because there's no VEV. Now, yeah.
Yeah, so you talk about vacuum expectation values, but what exactly is a vacuum here?
So it just means that in the ground state, in the vacuum, the field phi takes a non-zero value.
So what's the vacuum? Like you have an infinite number of field configurations with the same energy, ground state energy. So there's an infinite number of vacuum states.
In a sense, yes, but they're all related to one another by the symmetry transformation. So you're free to pick whichever one you want. If you pick a different choice, it's actually equivalent because you can relate your choice to my choice just by symmetry transformation.
Okay, so you actually chose one, and what you say there about the fields having certain vacuum expectation values is just your choice of vacuum.
In a sense, yes, but they're equivalent. So what we want to do now is just plug in this into our original Lagrangian and just expand it. So it's just a bit of algebra. So I'll just write this down. So first we have 1 half d mu phi 1 prime squared plus 1 half d mu phi 2 prime squared. Then we have minus mu squared phi 1 prime squared. And then minus lambda v phi 1 prime. And then I have phi 1 prime squared plus phi 2 prime squared. And minus lambda over 4 phi 1 prime squared plus phi 2 prime squared, quantity squared. Just took these relations, plugged it into Lagrangian, just expanded it, and then I just grouped it by the quadratic terms, the cubic terms, and the quartic terms. Okay, so that was just a bit of algebra. So now I want to look at the masses of these things. So here's the mass term for phi 1 prime. So phi 1 prime has mass m phi 1 prime squared is equal to 2 mu squared. And then similarly for phi 2 prime, it's massless. There's no mass term for phi 2 prime. This is a reflection of the fact that when you're here, you're free to move in the phi 2 direction without changing the energy. So there's no energy cost to moving in the phi 2 direction, which is just around the minimum. So no energy cost to move along the minimum. So what we see here is a consequence of what's known as Goldstone's theorem. It's a general result that for every symmetry that is broken, there's one massless degree of freedom, known as a Goldstone boson, per generator that is no longer a symmetry. So for every symmetry direction you break, you get a massless degree of freedom called the Goldstone boson. So now we just want to move on to a more complicated model, building up to the standard model, which is known as the Abelian-Higgs model. So we want to take the original model, which had this U1 symmetry, and we're just going to gauge it by introducing a photon. So the model is just a complex scalar phi with a local E1 gauge symmetry. Previously, we had the global symmetry. So you can think of this as scalar QVD. So we have the same Lagrangian we wrote down before, d mu phi squared plus e squared phi dagger phi minus lambda phi dagger phi squared. And then the new ingredient is I'm just going to add f mu nu squared for the photon. Oh, oops, I forgot something. The other new ingredient is, of course, I need to promote this to a covariant derivative. So I have a covariant derivative, d mu, which is just d mu plus I coupling constant g times a mu. And then f mu nu is just the usual field strength tensor, like so. All right. So now let's minimize this potential and see what it implies for the broken theory. So potential is the same as what we just had, minus mu squared phi dagger phi plus lambda phi dagger phi squared. And the minimum is the same. Where the magnitude of phi is equal to square root of mu squared over 2 lambda. And I'm going to call this v over square root of 2, as before. So now what we're going to do is just do exactly the same exercise and write down the shifted fields and then just plug them into the Lagrangian. So what does it do? Well, the potential part is exactly the same. Okay, that's the same as what I had before for the global case. The derivative part is the same. The only new difference here is the fact that this is a covariant derivative, and I have this term here with the gauge field. So the new part is the covariant derivative. So let's just work on those terms. So I'm just going to consider the covariant derivative part. So I want to square the following. I have d mu plus ig a mu acting on v plus phi 1 prime plus I phi 2 prime all over the square root of 2. And then I want to square that whole thing. So let me just expand this out a bit. And I'm just going to keep some of the terms because there's a lot. So this whole thing, so the terms I wrote down would be equal to, so there's a 1 half. And then I have d mu phi 1 prime plus I d mu phi 2 prime plus I g v a mu plus I g a mu phi 1 prime. And then I have a I think this should be a minus. G A2 A mu by 2 prime squared. Are those all the terms? I think I have it correct. Okay. All right, so I'm just going to expand out and keep only the quadratic terms. So I have 1 half d mu phi 1 prime squared plus 1 half d mu phi 2 prime squared, the usual kinetic terms for phi 1 and phi 2. I have a term like this, which is g v a mu d mu phi 2 prime. I have a 1 half g squared v squared a mu, and then plus dot, dot, dot. Well, these are cubic and quartic terms. OK, so the first thing to note is that, lo and behold, we have a mass term for our photon. All right? So the photon mass is ma squared, which is just g squared v squared. So there we go. We've generated what we've set out to generate, a mass for a gauge field. But there's one slightly tricky part, which is that we have this weird mixing term, which mixes the derivative of phi 2 with a mu. And so what we need to do is perform a field redefinition to get rid of that term, to translate the kinetic term for phi 2 prime in canonical form. So what we want to do is remove the mixing term. mu, d mu, phi 2 prime. Okay. So a simple way to do that is if we had expanded phi, not in terms of real and imaginary components, but in terms of polar coordinates, so what I want to do is write phi of x. So phi, again, is the original field. And I'm going to write it as the magnitude part, which I'll write in the following way. 1 over square root 2, v plus a field h of x. And then the phase, which I write as e to to ixc of x over v. And so instead of having phi 1 and phi 2 as the real and imaginary parts, my fields, my dynamical fields now are this h and c. You can expand them out, or I should say you can expand this out in the limit that the fields are small. And what you'll get is that you'll have 1 over square root of 2 v plus h x plus I c of x plus dot, dot, dot. And so the free part of the Hamiltonian will be essentially identical. So h and c would just be the real and imaginary parts in the limit that the fields are small. OK. So now what we want to do is perform a gauge transformation. And effectively, we can just perform a gauge transformation to remove this phase just by doing a U1 gauge transformation. So we want to say phi of x goes to e to the minus I c over v times phi. And now, of course, this phase will cancel this phase, and we'll just be left with something that's purely real. And so this whole thing will just be 1 over the square root of 2 v plus h of x, like so. OK, so we've made a gauge transformation to remove one of the degrees of freedom. This choice is called a unitary gauge. Okay, we also must transform a mu. So this is a mu prime, which is just a mu plus 1 over g v d mu c. And so now the covariant derivative which was d mu plus I g mu phi just goes to 1 over the square root of 2 d mu plus I g a mu prime and then v plus h, like so. So now let's expand the covariant derivative term in the Lagrangian. So here's the whole Lagrangian. We have 1 half d mu plus I g a mu acting on v plus h squared. Then we have mu squared over 2 v plus h squared minus lambda over 4 v plus h to the fourth, then I have minus 1/4 f mu nu, f mu nu. Okay. So now here's the Lagrangian in terms of the new fields, H. By doing this gauge transformation, we effectively remove C completely from the Lagrangian. This should be A prime. This should be F prime. Okay. Now I'm just going to drop the primes. Okay, we don't need the primes anymore. All right, so now let's just expand everything out. We have 1 half d mu h squared plus 1 half g squared v squared a mu plus g squared v a mu h. Then I have plus 1 half g squared h squared, a mu, and then I have the potential terms, which would be like e squared over 2 minus 3 halves lambda v squared, h squared, minus lambda v h cubed, minus lambda over 4th, h to the fourth minus 1/4 f mu nu. Okay, so I just did all the algebra for you. I just expanded these things out and grouped everything together as the cubic terms and quartic terms and also the quadratic terms. The other thing I need to use is that v squared is equal to mu squared over lambda. And so then this whole thing is just equal to minus mu squared. OK, so that's the mass term for the field H. All right, so now I have masses for all of these things. The state H, which you could call the Higgs, has a mass squared term, which is just 2 times mu squared. And the photon has a mass squared, which is just g squared times v squared. Oh, OK, I can just take the square root. The Higgs mass would just be the square root of 2 times mu. I can write it like that. Then the photon mass would just be g times v. Okay, those are the mass terms. Now I have the interaction terms as well. So I have this term, g squared v a mu h plus 1 half g squared h squared a mu, and minus lambda v h cubed minus lambda over 4th h to the 4th. So these are the interactions. But the important thing to note is that not all of the interactions have independent coefficients, right? So we have our masses, which are just given so we can relate mu squared to the mass of the Higgs, and then g times v to the mass of the photon. And then if we know g, then we're able to fix all of the coefficients that appear in the interaction term. So all the interactions are fixed. in terms of the actually just three parameters, you can think of it as MH, MA, and lambda, for example. Or I guess you could have G instead of lambda. So once you know a few parameters, you can fix all of the terms in the interaction Lagrangian. And so again, this is the sense in which the broken theory remembers that it originally came from a symmetric theory. If you just saw this theory, you would say, okay, my gauge boson has a mass, it can't be a gauge theory. But then you measure the interactions and it tells you that it originally came from a spontaneously broken gauge theory. So you might be worried that we lost one of the degrees of freedom. We originally had this degree of freedom, xi. This was the Goldstone boson. So you can think of it as the would-be massless Goldstone boson. It's no longer in the theory. It's removed from the theory. And so we say that it gets eaten. By the massive gauge field A. So originally we started out with a theory that had two scalar degrees of freedom, which you could call phi 1 and phi 2, plus two photon degrees of freedom, which are just the two transverse polarizations of A mu. And then after spontaneous symmetry breaking occurs, we're left with one real scalar degree of freedom. Which we call the Higgs field H, plus three degrees of freedom for A mu. Because now we have three polarizations. So the degrees of freedom are not lost, they just get transferred. The would-be Goldstone boson becomes the new longitudinal degree of freedom of the gauge field. Okay. Okay, so that's a good place to stop for today. What we'll do tomorrow is we'll go to fermion masses. So how can you generate fermion masses also using spontaneous symmetry breaking?